a mineral water spring, and pierced Polvi to the marrow. Having lived with their volcano since time immemorial, Sicilians treat its eruptions and its irksome showers of ash with equanimity. But when Mongibello makes its presence felt, no one remains unaffected. Everyone turns to look. Mimi did, too. Even Herdaline did. Polvi saw a huge fountain of lava erupt from the volcano. A wonderful sight. A last farewell. Things happen like that sometimes. So unforeseen, so immediate, so unmistakable. Suddenly, everything becomes clear. With this greeting from the volcano and death before her eyes, my Auntie Poldi was transfixed by a frisson of unbridled joie de vivre. In that brief instant, she realized how good it was to live between the sea and the volcano in company with the aunts, the mushrooms, Valerie, the sad signora, Montana, and all, and that she wanted to survive for a while longer, not just for this very last moment. She didn't really register Etna's second exhalation, because everything happened very quickly after that. Herdaline released her and spun round in alarm as Montana came storming out onto the roof. "Get him, Herdaline!" screamed Mimi. But before the Doberman could respond to changed circumstances and fly at Montana's throat, the policeman opened fire and Herdaline collapsed with a death rattle. Shocked by the volcanic eruption and his dog's swift demise, Mimi Pastorella clutched his heart, groaned, and collapsed likewise. Heart failure. Fatal. Nothing to be done. Chapter 15 describes my Auntie Polvi in close-up on her terrace, an embrace and a promise. The weather changes and Polvi has to turn up at police headquarters. Various matters need sorting out, not always with agreeable results. It's always the same. Just when you think something's over, something else gets in the way yet again. Stirred and inspired by my Auntie Poldi's account, I devoted the next day, my last day in the Via Baronessa for the time being, to rewriting the first chapter of my novel. Before emigrating to Munich, my great-grandfather Barnaba has to solve a murder. Decades earlier, the aristocratic landowner, Calogero Macaluso, brutally set his dog on an innocent peasant girl and hounded her to death for refusing him. Since then, legend has it that the ghost of a monstrous dog haunts the district and commits atrocities. When Macaluso's last surviving grandson is found torn to pieces in my great-grandfather's orange grove, he has to find the murderer in order to prove his own innocence. He succeeds in doing so thanks to his brilliant inductive logic and the assistance of the lovely Eleonora. Barnaba lays a trap for the dead grandson's rival, a relative of the murdered peasant girl, in the bleak Valle del Bove, shoots his trained Doberman, and ensures that the murderer gets his just deserts. As the chapter draws to a close, Barnaba and Eleonora make love al fresco while Etna erupts above them in a meaningful manner. I rewrote the chapter in a sort of frenzy. That evening, Polvi asked me to read it aloud to her. She listened attentively without interrupting, never fidgeted once or rolled her eyes. When I had finished and was regarding her nervously, she shook her head. "It's crap. Dump it." "Any constructive, dramatic, or stylistic comments?" She poured herself a scotch. "No. You can do much better, though. It's all a question of practice."
My Auntie Polvi knew a thing or two about storytelling.
But back to Polvi's showdown. In the background, the erupting volcano and the umpa-pa of the procession, which was just turning into the Via Baronessa. In close-up in the foreground, my Auntie Polvi, pale, wig askew but otherwise all right. She stared in shock at the two corpses on her terrace, Mimi's and Herdaline's, and at Montana, who felt Mimi's pulse and shook his head. He holstered his gun, rose to his feet and walked slowly over to Polvi, deliberately obstructing her view of the dead bodies.
"Are you all right?"
Polvi couldn't get a word out.
just stared at him.
Poldy?
She whispered something almost inaudible.
What did you say?
Could you...
Could I what, Poldy?
Could you please put your arms around me? No problem. Montana put his arms around my aunt and held her tight. He held her, silent and strong and rather sweaty, until her shock subsided at last and she was able to weep. And he continued to hold her in his arms, as if he never wanted to let go of her, until she gradually stopped trembling.
Better?
Poldy nodded and sniffed.
I have to call my team now, okay?
Poldy nodded again, but continued to hold him tight. He gently detached himself and looked into her eyes.
Like to sit down?
She shook her head. How did you get in? Montana held up one of the spare keys.
Assistente Rizzoli got this from one of your sisters-in-law. I'd been meaning to return it for ages.
I'm glad you took your time.
I'm glad you can smile again.
The procession was now making its way along the Via Baronessa.
The Madonna del Rosario, a meek but majestic figure, swayed past in her canopied palanquin, carried by 8 young men of Valentino's age.
Poldy didn't recognize the march, because the brass band's off-key rendition was mingled with the singing of Torre Archirafi's candle-bearing townsfolk, but she didn't care. It sounded wonderful. Heavenly. Namaste, life, she whispered.
Did you say something, Poldy?
No, nothing. Having alerted his colleagues, Montana shepherded Poldy down to the living room, sat her down on the sofa, thrust the musket aside, and poured her a glass of grappa. Drink this, it'll do you good,
Poldy said in a low voice. What?
You've got to say that. They always say that in films. Go on, say it.
Drink this, it'll do you good.
But I don't want to.
Don't be silly, Poldy, and don't budge. I'll deal with everything.
Don't go, Vito.
I'm not going.
Promise me?
I won't go, I promise. Shall I call your sisters-in-law?
Please don't. There's no rush.
Poldy registered little of all the forensic palaver that went on.
She nodded absently to Assistente Rizzoli, who was once more involved, answered questions she forgot the next moment, and saw Montana telephoning. She shuddered and started crying again despite herself, when the zinc coffin containing Mimi's corpse and Herdeline's plastic body bag were carried past her. Although she gradually recovered after 2 double grappas, it took her quite a while to grasp the full extent of what had happened. Montana had to tell her several times. He had intended to speak to her that night in any case, he said, on a private matter. He'd wanted to clarify something, straighten things out, clear the decks emotionally, shed light on the darkness, put his cards on the table. But that wasn't all. Their conversation that morning in the bar near the prefecture had haunted him all day long like a persistent salesman harassing an irresolute customer. He had been possessed by a strange kind of nervousness and vague irritability that spoilt his concentration and made him feel queasy, meteorologically speaking, all signs of an approaching cyclone. Montana detested indecision, especially in himself. He hated unresolved situations as much as unsolved cases. Falling between 2 stools and not knowing what to do infuriated him, made him insufferable towards his colleagues, and had become blended with his instinctive feeling that Patinet could not be Valentino's murderer into a vile cocktail of ill humour and heartache.
Did you say heartache?
Poldy cut in.
Let me finish, will you?
Forza, Vito. He hadn't been entirely honest with her, he went on. Her instinct hadn't, of course, deceived her. Alessia was a colleague, though in the administrative branch. He hated lies, he said. Lies were the worst thing of all. Lies were the enemy, the poison he had to swallow every day, the thing that could destroy you if you didn't take care. That was why he had meant to call on Poldy after work and clarify a few things.
He had been eating a sandwich in the car when he received this anonymous call. Number withheld, unfamiliar voice, brief message to the effect that the German signora might be in danger and he ought to hurry.
"Who was it?" asked Polvi.
"I told you. Anonymous. Obviously someone who knew what Mimi had in mind."
"A woman's voice?"
"No, a man's."
"How did he get your number?"
"Madonna, Polvi, I don't know. Anyway, I slapped the blue light on my roof at once and stepped on the gas." Needless to say, Polvi was itching to know what he had originally intended to clarify with her. In other words, which way the cookie would crumble as far as she was concerned. But Montana wasn't having any of it. He was tired, hungry, and sweaty. He'd shot a dog and failed to prevent a heart attack, saved my aunt's life, and solved a murder case. "I've had enough for one day," he said. And that's the way it stayed. The next day, Poldi had to go to police headquarters to make a statement. The volcanic eruption seemed to have ushered in a change in the weather. Towering above Etna, which was growling to itself, was a column of smoke and fire thousands of feet high. But the weather wasn't as hot as it had been. Veiled all over in cirrostratus, the sky dispensed a soft, milky light that smoothed the edges and outlines of the world and dispelled the lethargy of the summer. Sky and sea merged, and even Signor Busaco looked as energetic and supercharged as Livingston preparing to cross the Kalahari. Signora Corcuzza, who was obviously in the know, went so far as to wink at Poldi when she dropped in for a cappuccino and a cornetto. It was a good day. My auntie Poldi had often been in places she never wanted to leave but was compelled to. But this morning she felt she'd really come home at last. She told Signora Corcuzza about the anonymous call to Montana, but her new friend merely frowned and shook her head, and Poldi believed her. She then made a brief call to Teresa from the bar. She had informed her sisters-in-law of events in the Via Baronessa the previous night, although it had been late. She felt she owed them that, and besides, she needed Teresa's help in regard to an official matter. At 9 on the dot, cheerful, sober, and smelling of spring flowers, she presented herself at the prefecture in Asci Reali in a pistachio-coloured pencil skirt and a cream-coloured, very low-cut silk blouse. Sensually dark lipstick, sunglasses, and Nefertiti eyeliner for the requisite touch of drama, and beneath a headscarf with lemon motifs, a sort of tribute to Etna in the shape of her towering black Sunday wig. Everyone turned to look at her. She said good morning to the desk sergeant with the outsize Adam's apple, winked at the young policemen lounging against their patrol cars, and swung her hips like a 60s film star ready to mount the nearest Vespa or jump into the nearest fountain. Assistente Rizzoli found it hard to concentrate on his PC as Poldi dictated her statement. Attracted by the click of her ballpoint like a cat by the sound of a tin opener, Montana appeared in the doorway as soon as she had signed her deposition. He was wearing a dark suit with a black T-shirt and looked like a cross between a Russian oligarch and a star architect from Milan. In other words, by Poldi's standards, hot. He led her into his office at the end of the passage and shut the door.
"Are you going to have me on the floor?"
"Don't be silly, Poldi."
She got the message. The cookie hadn't crumbled her way.
"Pity. May I sit down?"
"Of course. Please do. You like something to drink?"
"Some water."
Montana disappeared, giving Poldi a brief opportunity to inspect his office. It looked the way she'd expected. Too small, too chock-a-block, too old, too stuffy, too depressing. A steel desk, a decrepit office chair with butterfly pattern upholstery, a prehistoric computer, folding chairs for visitors, a filing cabinet, stacks of papers on the floor, a crucifix on the wall, a map of Sicily, and a desk diary with no entries. It was just the way Poldi had always pictured Inspector Chance's office somewhere at the end of a passage. She was surprised they didn't keep the cleaners' mops and buckets in there as well.
See what I meant?
Montana asked from the doorway. She turned to look at him.
It's a shame. A disgrace.
Only another 3 years.
He sat down beside her on one of the folding chairs and handed her a glass of water.
We found the murder weapon at his house in Ashi Reale, together with a recording you made that dispels any doubt. Domenico Pastorella shot Valentino and very probably killed Marisa Puglisi as well. He was almost bankrupt, by the way, hence the deal with Patanay.
All I wonder is, who set up the deal?
What do you mean?
Patanay is a scumbag and an idiot. He'd never have approached Mimi without protection.
Russo, you mean?
Poldi made a dismissive gesture.
Pure speculation. Forget it. What did Mimi's wife Carmela say?
She seemed quite calm. Almost...
relieved?
Montana nodded.
She denies it, of course, but I think she knew the truth all along. Not that there's much of a chance we'll be able to prove it. I could spit.
Oh, Vito.
What you did was foolish and dangerous, Poldi. Not to mention the fact that you obstructed my investigation. You should have informed me far earlier.
You kept withholding information from me.
I'm a policeman.
And I'm me. The next time...
There won't be a next time, Poldi.
She said nothing.
Still, the chief did congratulate me earlier.
That's good. You know the joke about God creating Sicily out of a few offcuts and offsetting such a paradise by creating the Sicilians?
Yes, it's a classic. A good one.
No, Vito. It's balls. Sicily is a paradise. Sicilians and all. You saved my life yesterday. Which reminds me, have I thanked you yet?
He grinned at her.
Don't mention it.
If you go on smirking like that, I'll get naughty ideas. Well, now would be a good opportunity to tell me what you really meant to say last night.
Montana squirmed for a moment. Then he pulled himself together and awkwardly, long-windedly, explained that he and his colleague Alessia had been an item for the past 3 months.
Well, more or less an item, because their relationship was rather complicated too. But he had recently introduced her to his children, and it had gone really smoothly. But then the thing with my aunt had hit him like a bolt from the blue. He was only human, after all, and he couldn't help thinking of her all the time. But he was also a man of principle, and had had to learn to control his feelings, so he carried out emergency open-heart surgery on himself, and... well, he'd decided in favor of Alessia. He wound up looking like a marathon runner breasting the tape. Poldi remained silent. She could have recited the words of his monologue along with him. They sounded so familiar to her.
Poldi? Say something.
She drew a deep breath.
What utter crap,
she said eventually, getting to her feet.
If you think we're history, Vito, you're making a big mistake. It isn't over between us, not by a long chalk. Why not? Because you need me. What's she talking about, you may be thinking, but I know I'm right. I know it because I know a thing or two. One way or another, Vito Montana, you need me.
The day had begun so well. But before she knew it, Poldi was back outside the prefecture with a knot of sorrow and disappointment in her heart. The sorrow she bravely ignored because she had no wish to spoil such a nice day, which had felt like a 20th birthday. But the disappointment that no mafia tie-up had emerged throughout the case, as she had always assumed it would. The disappointment that she'd been unable to prove anything against Russo. Although she had kept the promise she'd made Valentino's lifeless body on the beach at Priola, the case didn't feel solved, and that bugged her. That was why she needed Teresa's and Martino's help. Having arranged to meet her in the Café Cipriani, they sat round a table spooning up granitas. Uncle Martino chatted with one of the waiters and lectured him on the absurdity of eating granitas in the evening. He asserted that the same thing applied to them as applied to Bavarian Weisswurst, the white sausages traditionally eaten in the morning, preferably for breakfast with a brioche, because the soft sorbet became crystallized and inedible in the bar's freezer compartment.
"You're looking well, Poldi," said Teresa. "I'm feeling well, too,"
Poldi lied. She ordered another granita mandorle cafe to fortify herself.
"You think they'll open it all up just like that?" "Martino knows one of the officials. An old friend he once showed where to find the best mushrooms on Etna, so there shouldn't be any problem. After all, they aren't secret documents, and we aren't the NSA."
"True.
In that case, let's go."
Only a short walk from the Piazza Duomo, the land registry of the Comune de Aciriali was housed in a magnificent Baroque palace. It might, from its appearance, have been a luxury hotel or the headquarters of the Spanish Inquisition, but no, it was a seat of local government. Poldi had been there once before to complete her residence registration formalities, and she well remembered the chaos that arose when the automatic queue ticket dispenser broke down. She did not have to take a ticket this time, however. She was greeted by a pale, ill-shaven, middle-aged man with protruding eyes, who kissed Teresa's hand and hailed Martino warmly like a pupil greeting the mentor who has taught him all he knows.
"This is my sister-in-law, Isolde Oberreiter," Martino told him.
"A pleasure to meet you, Signora. I hope we're not being a nuisance."
"Certainly not, Signora. I'd be delighted to be able to do my dear friend Martino a favor. If you come with me, I'll show you the records."
Poldi emerged from the Baroque palace 2 hours later, with Teresa and Martino and several photocopies in her hand, confident that she would, after all, be able to put the finishing touches to the Valentino case.
"Shall we come with you?" asked Teresa.
"No need. I'll manage."
A little later, on nearing the archway leading to Femina Morta, Poldi saw that the second lion was back in its accustomed place. It was looking sulkier than ever.
"Namaste, lion," she said,
and tooted twice. Word of Mimi's guilt and death, which had evidently spread like wildfire, had reached Femina Morta long ago.
"Mon Dieu, so it's really true,"
Valerie cried in dismay after Poldi had given her a preliminary account of what had happened.
"Beyond doubt," said Poldi. "And I must apologize for suspecting you. I only found out yesterday what your father must have been through. Is that why you left France and took over Femina Morta?"
Valerie pensively stirred her day-old reheated coffee.
"I don't know. Perhaps. I hardly knew him. You've no need to apologize."
They didn't speak for a while. The palm trees around them rustled as the mice in them tussled for ripe dates, while Oscar and Lady did the same lower down. Poldi spotted a dark shape wriggling through the tall grass between the avocado trees.
"It's not poisonous," Valerie told her. "On the contrary, they bring good luck."
Poldi nodded.
"I could use some."
Valerie looked at her.
"I'm not sure why I came to Femina Morta. Perhaps you're right. But I do know why I've stayed. Femina Morta is a good place, a place that protects its occupants. It also protected my father for a very long time, and it's a place that attracts good things and people. You, for instance, Poldi. As long as you come to visit me, I shall feel at home here. Understand?"
My aunt nodded. She knew a thing or two about good places, friendship, and things that sustain us.
"Maybe," said Valerie, "you'll introduce me sometime to the German nephew you're always talking about."
"Hello," I cut in at this point on my last evening in September. "You're always talking about me?"
"No, not always, just occasionally, more in passing."
"What do you tell her about me?"
The sort of thing one says when conversation starts to drag.
Like what?
Enough of the third degree. I don't owe you an explanation. I sighed.
So, Valerie would like to meet me sometime, would she?
You can put that out of your head for a start. You wouldn't hit it off, the two of you.
To change the subject quickly, she told me what she'd had to talk about with Russo, for it was on his account that she had come to Femina Morta. She had no need to go in search of him, however, because he appeared in the garden as if in response to a presentiment, wearing jeans, a T-shirt, and shades. Poldi now knew what the sad signora had meant about Russo's good looks.
"I heard from Turi that you were here,"
he said unceremoniously, joining Valerie and Poldi at the table.
"Glad to see you looking well, Donna Poldina."
He didn't remove his sunglasses. Poldi looked at him.
"And I owe it all to you, Signor Russo. Isn't that so?"
"Well, I don't understand."
"You were the anonymous caller who informed Commissario Montana I was in danger last night." "Mon Dieu!" Valerie exclaimed.
"I'm afraid I've no idea what you're talking about, Donna Poldina."
Poldi gestured impatiently.
"You knew all about Marisa Puglisi's murder. Valentino's too, perhaps."
She paused for a moment, never taking her eyes off him. Russo sat back in his chair.
"Thin ice, Donna Poldina. Do go on, though."
"By all means. I won't be able to prove you knew about Valentino, but I know one thing for sure. Valentino wasn't the first person to blackmail Mimi. The first was you."
"Really?
Mon Dieu!"
Poldi produced the photocopies she had made at the records office in Asci Reale and spread them out on the table.
39 years ago, shortly after Marisa's disappearance, you bought your first plot of land and set up your nursery."
"So what?"
"I wondered how you managed to amass so much money by selling a few wild palm trees. But you didn't need much money, because Mimi Pastorella sold you the land for peanuts."
"He needed the money."
"No, he needed your silence."
Poldi tapped the photocopies.
"These are just a few excerpts from the land register. In the past 40 years, you've repeatedly bought plots of land from Mimi Pastorella for a song. You blackmailed Mimi. You set up the deal between him and Patanay. You built up your palm tree empire on your knowledge of a murder, Signor Russo. The murder of a girl you were presumably once in love with."
Valerie said nothing. Russo didn't touch the photocopies, just glanced at them from a distance.
"So why did I warn Commissario Montana last night?"
"Because you knew that Mimi was done for. It was only a matter of time before everything came out, and you didn't want him to cause any more chaos, chaos that might affect you too."
Russo sighed.
"I like you, Donna Poldina. I really do. But with all due respect, you're barking up the wrong tree. You can't prove anything anyway. Look, I'm just a hard-working man who loves his land and his people. I've always worked hard. I come from a very humble background. My parents had nothing, but I, with a lot of hard work and a bit of luck, have made something of my life. And now I'm happy to be able to give a lot of people employment. That's all. I've never been involved in blackmail or any other form of sharp practice."
He rose.
"And now, if you'll excuse me, I must get back to work."
"One more thing," said Poldi.
She opened her bag and produced the photo of the topographical map she had taken in Taormina and had never been able to identify.
"Can you tell me what this is?"
Russo examined the photograph, turning it round 3 times.
"Some land I recently acquired up at Tre Castagni, a vineyard."
"Oh, you're going in for wine growing?"
Russo handed the photo back.
"I hope we see each other again soon, Donna Poldina."
"I'm quite sure we shall, Signor Russo."
An unequivocal statement. My Auntie Poldi drove home and removed the corkboard from her bedroom wall. She was sitting alone over the grappa bottle that evening when the doorbell rang. Montana. He was looking poorly. A nervous wreck, in fact. Poldi could see at once what the matter was, because she knew a thing or two about conditions of that kind.
Poldi, I...
Don't say anything, Vita, she said,
putting a finger to his lips and towing him into the house.
Not a word.
When I called my Aunt Louisa a few days later to say I'd be paying another visit in mid-September, she told me how relieved everyone was that our conspiratorial joie de vivre project had turned out so well. Poldi seemed far better adjusted, she said. She was showing a surprising interest in mushrooms and the fish market, meeting Valerie almost daily, and whispering now and then with the sad signora. She apparently received gentlemen visitors on a regular basis, and had recently developed a keen interest in viticulture.
"Hey, what does namaste mean?"
Louisa asked. "I think it's an Indian form of greeting." She giggled.
"Know what Poldi's been doing every morning lately? She goes up to the roof terrace stark naked, puts her hands together, and sings out, 'Namaste, Sicilia!' followed almost immediately by, 'The rest of the world can kiss my ass.'"
That was good news. With many people, however, joie de vivre resembles a volcanic eruption. No matter how fervent and intense, it sooner or later gives way once more to calm and melancholy. So the sisters and I were relieved when my Auntie Poldi encountered her next murder case soon afterwards.
We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Auntie Poldi and the Sicilian Lions by Mario Giordano. Text copyright 2015, Mario Giordano. English translation copyright 2016, John Brown John. Production copyright, Hodder & Stoughton Limited, 2018. All rights reserved. For more information about this and all of our unabridged audiobooks, please visit www.hodder.co.uk.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.